This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, the smart flashcards, and, you know, unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. So check it out at CertFuel.com.
Yeah, it's an incredible resource, honestly.
It really is, especially for like what we are tackling today. So let's talk about why you are here with us. You're listening to this, you are on a mission, right? We are mastering fixed income characteristics and valuation for the Series 65 exam.
Huge topic.
Massive. I mean, imagine holding a piece of paper that guarantees you $1 million in 20 years, but right now, today, it pays you absolutely nothing.
Right. Zero.
And worse, the IRS just knocks on your front door every single year demanding taxes on invisible money you haven't even received yet. So welcome to the bizarre, highly counterintuitive world of bond valuation.
It is a world that defies normal logic. Well, at least until you understand the underlying mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Because in our previous discussions, we spent a lot of time just putting labels on things.
Right, like definitions.
Yeah, exactly. We identify what a treasury bond is, what a municipal bond is, you know, corporate bonds.
Yeah.
But today is entirely different. We are moving from identification to behavior.
Right.
Today is about how these bonds actually behave in the wild, how they react to the economy, and most importantly, how to mathematically price them.
Yeah, let's set the stakes for you. When you sit down at that testing center, this specific material makes up about 4 questions on your exam. So that is roughly 3% of the entire test.
Which doesn't sound like a lot.
It doesn't. 3% might not sound like a mountain, but here's the catch. You cannot fake your way through these questions. I mean, this material requires you to synthesize multiple constantly moving concepts, pricing, yields, duration, tax implications, risk, and you have to juggle them all at the exact same time under the pressure of the exam clock.
Yeah, that's the real challenge. You can't just memorize a static textbook definition and expect to pass.
Yeah.
You have to understand the physical mechanics of the market. You need to know the why and the how.
Absolutely. And look, if you are anything like me and you have that ADHD learning style where dry, monotone textbook lectures just bounce right off your brain like, you know, a tennis ball against a brick wall, do not worry. I see you.
They're not doing that today.
No way. We are not doing a dry lecture today. We are not going to read a list of bullet points. We have to make this stick. And to do that, we are bringing in some friends. We're going to use 3 recurring fictional characters today to really anchor every single one of these complex hypotheticals.
Having a cast of characters makes these very abstract mathematical concepts feel, you know, very grounded and real.
Totally. So let's meet the crew. First, we have Cautious Carl. Carl is just terrified of risk. He practically sleeps with his money stuffed under his mattress. He hates paying taxes. He hates volatility. And he only wants absolute ironclad guarantees.
Okay, classic conservative investor.
Right. Next, we have Daredevil Dave. Dave is a total adrenaline junkie. He trades on his phone while skydiving. He chases high yields completely blindly. Like, if an investment promises a 20% return, Dave is buying it instantly without reading a single word of the fine print.
We all know a Dave, unfortunately.
Oh, we definitely do. And finally, on the other side of the table, we have corporate Chloe. Chloe is a ruthless, high-powered bond issuer. She runs a massive, slightly unstable manufacturing company.
Right.
And she does not care about Carl. She does not care about Dave. She only cares about her company's bottom line and getting the absolute cheapest debt possible. And she will use every legal trick in the book to exploit her investors.
Those three are going to be very busy today.
They are. Okay. Let's unpack this and jump right into the deep end, because mm-hmm. before we can even look at what a bond pays you, we have to look at what the government takes away from you, right?
The taxes.
Yeah. Let's talk about the silent partner in every single investment, the IRS. I know there are baseline rules for bond taxation, but I always get them jumbled up. So walk me through the hierarchy.
Sure. So the baseline rules are actually quite logical if you think about who is issuing the debt. Let's start with the big one, U.S. Treasury securities. Because these bonds are issued by the federal government, they are subject to federal income tax.
Okay, makes sense.
However, they are exempt from state and local taxes. The underlying logic here is a concept of mutual sovereignty. The federal government doesn't allow individual states to tax federal debt because, well, that would give states the power to financially burden the federal government.
Right, so the federal government issues it, the federal government taxes it, but they tell the states to back off.
Exactly.
Okay, so what about corporate bonds? Like the ones our ruthless corporate Chloe issues.
Corporate bonds are fully taxable at every conceivable level. You pay federal income tax, you pay state income tax, And, you know, if your city has a local income tax, you pay that too. There are absolutely no tax breaks for lending your money to a for-profit corporation.
Yeah, Chloe isn't doing society a favor. She's just running a business, right? But then we have the interesting category, municipal bonds. Munis. This is where local governments borrow money to build, like, public high schools, repave roads, fix water treatment plants.
Right. Public works.
Mm.
And because these are public works projects, the federal government cuts them a massive break. So the interest earned on municipal bonds is generally exempt from federal income tax. It's really a way for the federal government to subsidize local infrastructure without paying for it directly.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. By making the interest tax free, local governments can borrow money at much lower interest rates because investors are willing to accept a lower yield in exchange for that tax break.
Okay, so I have a direct question for you, the listener. I want you to think about this scenario. Let's take cautious Carl. Carl lives in a high-rise apartment in New York City. He decides to buy a New York City municipal bond to fund a new subway line. What happens to his taxes on the interest he earns from that specific bond?
We'll give you a beat to think about it. Federal, state, local second. What does he actually pay?
Got your answer. If cautious Carl lives in New York City and buys a New York City muni, he achieves the absolute holy grail of tax treatment. He gets what we call triple exempt status.
Yeah.
He pays zero federal tax because it's a muni.
Right.
He pays zero New York state tax because he bought a bond issued within his home state. And he pays zero New York City local tax because he bought a bond issued by his home municipality. He gets to keep every single penny of that interest.
And that is a crucial concept, right? Because if Carl lived in New York City but bought a municipal bond issued by the city of Los Angeles, California, well, the federal government still wouldn't tax it.
Because it's still a muni.
Exactly. But New York State and New York City absolutely would tax that interest because they have zero incentive to subsidize California's infrastructure. You only get that double or triple exemption if you buy bonds issued in your home state.
I get that. But hold on. This creates a massive headache for me as an investor, or, you know, for you listening as a future investment advisor. How on earth do you compare a tax-free municipal bond to a fully taxable corporate bond? It feels like comparing apples to a toaster.
It really does.
Like, let's say corporate Chloe offers a bond paying 5%, and a local school district offers a muni paying 3%. Daredevil Dave just looks at his screen, sees the 5, sees the 3, and yells, "Give me the corporate bond." Dave is totally ignoring the tax drag. How do we level the playing field so Dave can actually see what he's making?
So we have to translate the municipal bond's yield into a language that Daredevil Dave understands. We use a formula called the taxable equivalent yield, or TEY. The TEY tells us exactly what a fully taxable corporate bond would have to pay in order to equal the tax-free muni bond after Uncle Sam takes his cut.
Okay, I want to map this out mathematically. What's the formula?
The formula is the tax-exempt yield divided by the result of 1 minus the investor's marginal tax rate. So TEY equals muni yield over 1 minus tax rate.
Let's run a real-world scenario. Let's say cautious Carl is a highly paid surgeon. He's doing very well, so he's in the absolute highest federal tax bracket. Let's call it 37%. And he's looking at that municipal bond paying a clean 3% yield. How do we run the TEY?
We just plug the numbers in. The numerator on top is the muni yield, which is 3%. The denominator on the bottom is 1 minus his tax rate. So 1 minus 0.37 leaves us with 0.63. Then you divide 3% by 0.63.
And if you're sitting in a testing center and you type 3 divided by 0.63 into your basic calculator, it spits out 4.76%. But let's pause. What does that 4.76% actually represent in the real world for Carl?
It means that for Carl, in his specific tax bracket, earning 3% completely tax-free is mathematically identical to earning 4.76% on a fully taxable corporate bond.
Wow, okay.
So if corporate Chloe calls him up and offers him a corporate bond paying 4.5%, Carl should hang up the phone and buy the 3% muni. Because even though 4.5 is a bigger number than 3, after Carl pays 37% in taxes on Chloe's bond, he will be left with less money in his pocket than the muni provides.
Right. So the core takeaway here, the absolute fundamental rule you must remember, is that the higher your tax bracket, the more incredibly valuable a municipal bond becomes to you.
Exactly.
Like if Daredevil Dave is working a part-time job and is in a super low 10% tax bracket, that TEY math doesn't work out nearly as well for him. For Dave, 3 divided by 0.90 is only 3.33%. So Dave should totally buy Chloe's 4.5% corporate bond. Munis are designed for high earners.
That's right. The benefit scales with your tax burden.
Now wait, hang on. I'm clapping my hands here. Listen up. This is where the exam tries to get you. You see the word municipal bond on the exam and your brain instantly screams tax-free. But are all municipal bonds always federal tax-free for everyone, no matter what?
No, they are absolutely not. And this is vital. You need to watch out for something called private activity bonds. So most municipal bonds are for things that benefit the general public schools, roads, sewers. But sometimes a municipality issues a bond to build something that acts a lot more like a private for-profit business.
Like what?
Think about a new terminal for a specific airline at an airport, or, you know, a brand new stadium for a billionaire sports team.
Okay, so the city issues the debt, but a private company is really the one benefiting from it.
Correct. And the federal government doesn't like subsidizing private businesses. So for most average investors, the interest on these private activity bonds might still be tax-free. But for high-income earners who are subject to the alternative minimum tax, or AMT, the interest on these specific bonds suddenly becomes fully taxable at the federal level.
Okay, so if you are taking the exam and you see the phrase private activity bond, your brain should immediately flash a big neon sign that says AMT. If your client is subject to the alternative minimum tax, keep them far away from private activity bonds.
That is exactly the association you need to make. Private activity equals AMT.
Awesome. Okay, let's pivot to something that feels genuinely criminal. Let's talk about the scariest thing in the tax code, the phantom menace. We are talking about zero coupon bonds and original issue discount, or OID. I have an absurd analogy for this that I use to keep it straight.
Ooh, I've got to hear this. Let's hear it.
Okay. Imagine phantom income is like a ghost that visits your living room every single year on December 31st. The ghost floats through the wall, walks up to you, and hands you an invisible bag of cash. You can't see this cash. You can't spend this cash. The grocery store does not exist in the physical realm.
Right.
But right behind the ghost, walking through the same wall, is an IRS agent. And the IRS agent points at the invisible bag of cash and says, I see that invisible money and I demand that you write me a check for real physical tax money on it right now.
It sounds like a nightmare, but honestly, that is the exact lived experience of owning a taxable zero coupon bond.
But why? Help me understand the logic here. Why on earth does the IRS tax you on money you have not received yet?
Well, you have to look at how a zero coupon bond is structured. A normal bond pays you a cash interest payment every 6 months. But a zero coupon bond pays you zero interest along the way. Instead, you buy it at a massive discount.
Mm.
Let's say Daredevil Dave pays $800 today for a bond that promises to mature and pay him $1,000 in 10 years.
Okay, so that $200 difference, the gap between the $800 he paid and the $1,000 he gets at the end, that is his profit. That's his interest.
Exactly. But the IRS looks at that 10-year timeline and says, we are not going to wait 10 years to collect our tax revenue on your profit. So the tax code requires you to do something called accretion. You must gradually add or accrete a mathematical portion of that $200 discount to your taxable income every single year. So maybe you add $20 to your income this year and $20 next year. Even though Dave is getting zero actual cash in the mail, the IRS taxes him annually as if he were receiving that $20 in cash. This is phantom income. And crucially, it is taxed as ordinary income, not capital gains.
Okay, so here is a question for you listening. Think about cautious Carl. We know Carl despises paying taxes. If Carl decides he absolutely must buy a zero coupon corporate bond because he likes knowing exactly what he'll have in 10 years, where is the absolute best place for him to hold this bond? What kind of account should he put it in?
Take a moment to think about the account types available to an investor.
Got it. The answer is a tax-deferred account. Like an IRA, a 401k, or a 529 college savings plan. Think about our ghost analogy. If the phantom income ghost visits an IRA, the IRS agent cannot get inside the account. The door is locked.
Right, they can't get in.
The phantom income still mathematically happens inside the account, but because the IRA acts as a tax shelter, Carl does not owe taxes out of his own pocket year by year. You should practically never put a taxable zero coupon bond in a regular taxable brokerage account unless you just enjoy draining your checking account to pay taxes on invisible money.
That is a phenomenal exam point.
Hmm.
Zero coupon bonds belong in tax-advantaged accounts.
Hmm.
But while we are on the topic of discounts, we need to clarify a very tricky distinction that trips a lot of people up. We just talked about original issue discount, or OID, where the bond is literally born at a discount. It was issued brand new at $800. Hmm. But what if the discount happens later? What about a market discount?
Oh, right. Let's picture Daredevil Dave. Dave isn't buying brand new bonds from corporate Chloe. He is browsing the secondary market on his laptop, buying used bonds from other investors who want out. Let's say he finds a bond that originally came out at $1,000 par. But the market has tanked and the original owner is desperate, so Dave buys this used bond for $900. That is a market discount.
Correct. And the tax treatment of a market discount is entirely different from an OID. With a market discount bond, you generally do not have to deal with the annual phantom income ghost. You get to wait.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you wait until you sell the bond or until it finally matures at $1,000 before you deal with the tax on that $100 profit.
Okay, so Dave holds the bond to maturity. He bought it for $900. It matures at $1,000. He makes a crisp $100 profit. But here is where the trap snaps shut. How is that $100 profit taxed? I mean, Dave thinks to himself, I bought an asset low and I sold it high in the open market. This is textbook capital gains.
Dave is wrong, and the exam will actively try to trick you into agreeing with him. It will offer capital gains as option A, but it is not a capital gain. That market discount profit is treated as ordinary income.
Wait, really? But why? If I buy a stock at $900 and sell at $1,000, that's capital gains. Why is a bond different?
Because the IRS views the discount on a bond differently than the price appreciation of a stock. The IRS argues that the only reason Dave was able to buy that bond at a discount in the first place is because the bond's interest rate was lower than the current market rates.
Ah, I see.
Therefore, that $100 discount is essentially acting as a substitute for the missing interest. And interest, in the eyes of the IRS, is always, always taxed as ordinary income. Whether it is an original issue discount or a market discount, the IRS treats that discount profit as ordinary income.
Wow. Okay, that is a subtle but massive difference. If it's a bond discount, think ordinary income. So, we've got the taxes sorted out. We know Uncle Sam is going to get his piece. But let's transition to a new problem. What if cautious Carl buys a bond, gets completely spooked by the news the next day, and decides he needs that cash back tomorrow to pay for a medical emergency? How easily can he get out of this bond?
That brings us to the reality of the liquidity spectrum. Liquidity is simply a measure of how quickly and easily you can turn your bond back into cold, hard cash without having to drastically slash the price to find a buyer.
I want to rank them. Which bonds can I sell in a heartbeat, and which ones are going to leave me stranded?
At the very top, the undeniable king of liquidity are U.S. Treasuries. The market for U.S. government debt is the most liquid financial market on the planet. You can buy or sell millions of dollars of treasuries in a fraction of a second.
That fast.
Oh, yeah. And the bid-ask spreads. That's the difference between what a buyer is willing to pay and what a seller is demanding are incredibly tight, often just pennies.
Okay, so treasuries are basically cash. What's next down the line?
Next is the corporate bond market. But you have to be careful here because liquidity varies wildly. If you hold a bond from Apple or Microsoft, it is highly liquid. But if you hold a bond from corporate Chloe's midsize, slightly sketchy manufacturing company, that is going to be far less liquid. You might have to wait to find a buyer, and the bid-ask spreads will be wider, meaning you lose a little more money in the transaction.
And at the absolute bottom of the liquidity barrel, the hardest to sell.
Municipal bonds. They're generally the least liquid of all the major fixed income categories.
You know, this never made sense to me until I visualized it. Imagine the treasury market is like trying to resell a classic pristine Beatles record. Everyone on earth knows what it is. Everyone agrees on its general value. And there are millions of buyers waiting to take it off your hands.
Right.
But the municipal bond market is completely fractured. There are thousands upon thousands of tiny local issuers. Selling a muni is like trying to resell a custom-made t-shirt for a high school marching band in a town of 3,000 people. Does the t-shirt have value? Sure, maybe to an alumni of that school, but how long is it going to take you to find that one specific buyer who actually wants that exact t-shirt?
That is the perfect analogy. The muni market is deeply fragmented. You have tiny issue sizes, incredibly specific local projects, and almost zero national visibility for most of these bonds. Because of that, the bid-ask spreads are the widest.
Makes sense.
If cautious Carl needs to sell a highly specific local muni bond in a blind panic on a Tuesday afternoon, the only buyer available might demand a massive discount. Carl's going to take a haircut on the price. That is a liquidity risk in action.
Okay, so that is selling a bond when the market is functioning normally. but I want to set up a much more disastrous scenario. Let's say corporate Chloe's manufacturing company has been recklessly managed. She took on too much debt, sales plummeted, and the company goes totally, completely bankrupt. The metaphorical building is literally on fire.
Oh boy.
Yeah. All the investors, the bondholders, the stockholders, the banks, they're all lined up outside the burning building waiting to get whatever cash is left in the company safe before it all burns down.
Mm-hmm.
Who gets out first? Who gets paid first in a corporate liquidation?
The exam will test you on this exact priority lineup. You have to know the pecking order. The absolute first people in line standing right by the door are the secured creditors.
Who are they?
These are bondholders whose debt is backed by physical, tangible collateral. Think about mortgage bonds that are backed by the company's real estate, or equipment trust certificates backed by airplanes or heavy machinery. If Chloe goes bankrupt, these investors don't even have to wait for the cash in the safe. They literally have the legal right to seize the factory, sell the physical building, and take their money back. They are the safest.
Right. Secured means you have a claim to physical stuff. So who is second in line?
Number two is unsecured creditors. These are the holders of what we call debentures.
I hate that word, debenture. It sounds so complicated.
It really is just a fancy, antiquated word for a bond that is backed by absolutely nothing except the company's full faith and credit. It's a promise to pay based on their general credit worthiness, not on physical collateral. They don't get to sell the factory, but they are second in line for whatever cash is generated by selling off the company's remaining general assets.
Okay, so secured, then unsecured debentures. Who is third?
Number three is subordinated debentures. Subordinated literally means lower in rank. These are unsecured bondholders who explicitly agreed in their contract to stand behind the regular debenture holders.
Wait, why? Why would anyone agree to stand further back in the line of a burning building?
Because corporate Chloe paid them to. Daredevil Dave probably bought the subordinated debentures because Chloe offered an 8% interest rate, while the regular debentures only paid 6%. Dave took on more liquidation risk in exchange for a higher yield.
Typical Dave. Okay, so we have secured, unsecured, subordinated. We are down to the dregs. Who is fourth?
Now we cross the line from debt into equity. Number four is preferred stockholders.
And finally, dead last, standing in the ashes, holding an empty, burnt bucket.
Common stockholders. Number five, they are the absolute last to see a penny. And in most bankruptcies, they get completely wiped out.
The memory aid here that I want you to tattoo on the inside of your eyelids is this: debt before equity. Secured before unsecured. Let me say it again. Debt before equity, secured before unsecured. Think about how profound that is.
Yep.
Even the absolute lowest, riskiest, most reckless, subordinated debenture bondholder gets paid completely in full before the fanciest, most privileged preferred stockholder gets a single dime.
And we should explain the why behind that rule. Why does debt always beat equity? Because a bond is a legally binding contract to repay a loan. Equity or stock is simply an ownership stake.
Right.
Like if you own a house and you owe the bank money on your mortgage and you decide to sell the house, the bank gets paid their loan balance first before you get to take any of your home equity out. The exact same concept applies to a corporation. The lenders get paid before the owners.
Brilliant. Okay, know that list in order. Secured, unsecured, subordinated, preferred, common. Now let's keep the focus on corporate Chloe. She survived the bankruptcy hypothetical, and she is back to running her company. She is ruthless, and she loves holding the power. We need to talk about call features, or what I like to call the issuer's remote control.
This is where we see the power dynamic shift entirely in favor of the corporation.
Exactly. Chloe issues bonds because she needs to borrow money to build a new factory. Let's say it's 2023, inflation is high, and the only way she can get people to buy her bonds is by offering a massive 8% interest rate. But roll the clock forward a few years. The economy changes, inflation cools down, and general market interest rates fall drastically down to 4%. Chloe is furious. She is stuck paying 8% to her bondholders when the going rate is only 4%. What does she do?
She uses her remote control. If she was smart when she designed the bonds, and Chloe is always smart, she issued callable bonds. A call feature is an embedded option that gives the issuer the legal right to force the investor to give the bond back to them early, before the maturity date.
It's exactly like refinancing a house. If you have a horrible 8% mortgage and rates drop to 4%, you don't just sit there and keep paying 8% for 30 years. You call the bank, you pay off the old expensive mortgage, and you take out a brand new cheap one. Chloe does the exact same thing to her bondholders. She pays them back their principal, maybe throws in a tiny extra premium to satisfy the contract, cancels the 8% bonds, and issues new ones at 4%.
Precisely. Issuers call bonds when interest rates fall. That is the trigger.
So here is a question for you listening. Think about cautious Carl. Carl bought that 8% bond. He was thrilled. He thought he locked in 8% for the next 20 years. Does a callable bond benefit Carl in any way, shape, or form?
Take a beat and think about the mechanics of what just happened to his investment.
Nope. No. It is an absolute nightmare for Carl. Callable bonds benefit the issuer 100%. Because think about what Carl has to do now. Chloe pressed the remote control and forcefully handed Carl his $1,000 back. What does Carl do with that cash?
He has to go reinvest it in the current market. But we just established that current interest rates have crashed to 4%. So Carl is forced to trade his beautiful 8% income stream for a miserable 4% income stream.
Ouch. This is called reinvestment risk, and it is the primary devastating danger of a callable bond. To make up for this terrible risk, if Chloe wants anyone to buy her callable bonds in the first place, she has to offer a concession. She has to pay a slightly higher coupon rate up front compared to a normal non-callable bond. But there is another effect of the call feature, and it is a fascinating piece of market psychology called price compression or negative convexity.
This is a sophisticated concept, but we can break it down.
Yeah, I want you to visualize a glass ceiling floating right above the bond's price. Normally, if you hold a non-callable bond paying 8% and the rest of the market plummets to 4%, your 8% bond becomes a rare, incredibly valuable artifact. People will pay a massive premium to buy it from you. The price skyrockets.
That is the normal inverse relationship. Rates go down, prices go up.
Right, but not with callable bonds. If Chloe's bond is callable at, let's say, $1,020, the price of that bond in the open market will almost never go much higher than $1,020. It hits the glass ceiling.
Exactly.
Why? Because the market isn't stupid. Why on earth would Daredevil Dave pay you $1,200 for your bond in the open market if he knows corporate Chloe is going to press her remote control tomorrow morning and forcefully take it away from him for only $1,020? He would instantly lose $180.
He wouldn't do it. And because no rational buyer will pay more than the call price, the call feature artificially caps the upside potential of the bond's price. The issuer is never going to let the price soar. They are just going to call it away.
This phenomenon where the price upside is aggressively capped when rates fall, but the downside price risk is fully exposed when rates rise, is called negative convexity. The math is completely rigged against the investor.
But, you know, it's important to note that the remote control can occasionally be in the hands of the investor. It's rare, but it exists.
Ah, yes. The puttable bond. This is the exact reverse. A put feature gives the investor the right to force the issuer to buy the bond back at par value. When would cautious Carl use this superpower? Think about it.
When would Carl want to get rid of his bond and get his money back?
When interest rates rise. If Carl is holding a bond paying 4% and market rates suddenly shoot up to 8%, Carl's 4% bond is suddenly terrible. Its market price is dropping like a stone. But if it's a puttable bond, Carl smiles, presses his remote control, and forces Chloe to buy the bond back from him for a full $1,000. Then Carl takes that $1,000 and reinvests it in the new, higher 8% bonds.
It is a phenomenal, almost bulletproof protection for the investor against rising interest rates. But as always in finance, there is no free lunch. Because this put feature is a superpower for the investor, the issuer will demand a major concession. Puttable bonds will almost always pay a lower coupon rate than a comparable normal bond. You are paying for that insurance policy by accepting less interest every single year.
That makes total sense. The issuer's remote is the call. The investor's remote is the put. That covers the features. Now, I need everyone listening to stretch, shake it out, and focus, because we are diving into the single most counterintuitive, frequently misunderstood concept on the entire Series 65 exam duration.
Oh, duration trips up more candidates than almost anything else. We need to be very precise about what it is and what it is not.
Exactly. I'll admit, when I first started learning this, I thought duration was just a fancy SAT synonym for maturity. Like, the duration of a movie is how long it lasts. So the duration of a bond is 10 years, but that is completely wrong, isn't it?
It is entirely wrong. Maturity is a simple calendar date. It is the exact day the bond ends and the final principal is returned. Duration is entirely different. Duration is the weighted average time it takes to receive all of the bond's cash flows, both the semi-annual interest coupons and the final principal payment. It's expressed in years, yes, but what it actually measures is the bond's price sensitivity to interest rate changes.
Okay, that definition is very technical. I use the heavy backpack analogy to make this physical. I want you to imagine Daredevil Dave is going on a hike. The length of the hike represents the 10-year maturity of the bond. Now, if Dave has a high coupon bond, say, paying 10%, it means the bond is paying him large amounts of cash every 6 months.
Right.
So in our analogy, every 6 months on the trail, someone walks up to Dave and hands him a heavy bag of cash to put in his backpack. Because he is recovering his original investment so quickly, piece by piece, he is firmly grounded. He is stable. The heavy cash in his backpack lowers his center of gravity and makes him less sensitive to the winds of future interest rate changes. Because he gets paid so much so early, the weighted average time he waits for his money shrinks. Therefore, a higher coupon means a lower duration.
That is the crucial, deeply counterintuitive relationship you must memorize. Higher coupon equals lower duration, and lower duration equals lower price volatility. Because you are getting your money back sooner, you don't care quite as much about what interest rates do 5 or 10 years from now.
I am explicitly warning you, the test writers love this trick. The exam will ask you a question like, which bond is more volatile when interest rates change? Bond A is a 10-year bond with an 8% coupon. Bond B is a 10-year bond with a 2% coupon.
And if you don't know duration, you get it wrong.
Right. If you don't know duration, you might think, oh, the 8% bond is bigger, it must be more volatile. Wrong. The 2% coupon bond is way more volatile. It has a higher duration because the investor is practically starving for cash the whole hike, carrying an almost empty backpack, waiting desperately for that final principal payment at the end of 10 years to make them whole. They are highly sensitive to the wind.
Now take that exact logic to its absolute mathematical extreme. What happens if we look at a zero coupon bond?
Maximum danger. If Dave buys a 20-year zero coupon bond, he gets zero interest for 20 years. His backpack is completely empty the entire hike. He is incredibly unstable. A strong breeze will blow him off the mountain. Because there are literally no coupon payments to pull that weighted average time forward, the duration of a zero coupon bond is exactly equal to its maturity. A 20-year zero has a duration of exactly 20 years. And then at the very end of the hike, he gets handed one giant anvil of cash all at once.
And this creates a beautiful paradox that the exam loves to test. We touched on this with taxes, but let's look at the risk profile.
Let's ask the listener, think about it. With a zero coupon bond, what is your reinvestment risk and what is your interest rate risk? Take a beat.
Try to break the paradox down.
With a zero coupon bond, your reinvestment risk is zero. Why? Because you aren't receiving any coupons along the way. There is literally nothing to reinvest. You don't have to worry about finding a good rate for your cash because you have no cash.
Yeah.
But T, your interest rate risk, the risk that the bond's price will swing wildly in the secondary market if overall rates change, is the absolute highest of any bond in existence. Maximum volatility. You are locked in a 20-year room with no cash flow, totally at the mercy of the market.
That is exactly right. Zero reinvestment risk, maximum interest rate risk. That is the hallmark of a zero coupon bond. Now, the exam might try to get cute and test you on different flavors or types of duration. You need to be familiar with three specific names: Macaulay, modified, and effective.
Let's walk through them. What's the difference?
Macaulay duration is the original. It is the theoretical mathematical calculation of that weighted average time in years that we just discussed. It's the baseline formula developed in the 1930s. Modified duration is the next step. It takes that Macaulay duration and mathematically adjusts it by the bond's current yield to maturity to give you a more accurate percentage measure of price sensitivity. Modified duration works beautifully for normal, plain vanilla, non-callable bonds.
But then we have effective duration. And this is where people lose points. Listen closely. If a bond has a call feature, if corporate Chloe is standing there holding her remote control, you cannot use modified duration. Why?
Because modified duration is blind.
Exactly. It is blind to the glass ceiling we talked about earlier. Modified duration assumes the bond's price will just keep rising smoothly forever if interest rates fall. It doesn't know that Chloe's going to press the button and crush the price. You must use effective duration. Effective duration is specially calculated to account for the price compression, the negative convexity of that embedded call option. So if the exam says which duration measure is most appropriate for a callable bond, the answer is always, unequivocally, effective duration.
Perfect. Now, why do we care so much about this duration number in the real practical world of portfolio management? Because duration gives you a math shortcut. It tells you almost exactly how much money you're going to lose if things go wrong.
Oh, let's do the shortcut. The formula is the approximate price change of a bond equals negative duration multiplied by the change in interest rates. Let's say cautious Carl owns a bond portfolio with a duration of 7. Tomorrow, inflation data comes out hot, and the Federal Reserve panics and raises interest rates by 1%. What happens to the value of Carl's portfolio?
You multiply the duration of 7 by the 1% rate increase. But remember, the formula has a negative sign. Negative 7 times 1 means the price of Carl's portfolio will fall by roughly 7%. If the Fed raised rates by 2%, the price would fall by roughly 14%. Duration gives you a quick, dirty, and highly effective estimate of price volatility.
And what about convexity? You see that word pop up in relation to duration? It sounds like an advanced physics term.
It is advanced, but the concept is simple. Convexity is just the refinement of that duration estimate. Duration is an approximation. It assumes the relationship between a bond's price and its yield is a perfectly straight line on a graph. Mm. Convexity recognizes that the real world isn't a straight line, it's a curve.
And why does that curve matter?
Because positive convexity is a beautiful thing for investors. A curved relationship means that when interest rates drop, the price of your bond rises faster and faster. The gains accelerate. But when rates go up, the price of your bond falls slower and slower. The losses decelerate. You get more upside than downside for the same exact movement in interest rates. Mm. Normal, non-callable bonds have positive convexity.
But callable bonds, because they hit that glass ceiling, have negative convexity. The curve bends the wrong way, capping your gains but leaving your losses fully exposed. So duration tells us how much the price moves, but I want to talk about the physical mechanics of bond pricing in the open market. What actually makes a bond trade at par or premium or discount?
It all comes down to the golden rule of fixed income, which you can easily visualize as a physical playground seesaw.
Yes, the seesaw. Picture this in your mind right now. On the left seat of the seesaw, you have market interest rates. On the right seat of the seesaw, you have bond prices. Because they are on a rigid wooden seesaw, they must always move in opposite directions. If market interest rates go up into the air, the price of existing bonds gets pushed down into the dirt. If market rates go down, the price of existing bonds goes up. Always. It is a strict inverse relationship.
But we cannot just memorize that as a magic trick. We need to explain why it works that way. It's basic human economics.
Let's map it out. Let's say cautious Carl buys a brand new bond directly from corporate Chloe. It pays a 5% coupon, and Carl pays a full $1,000 for it. That is called trading at par. The coupon Carl is getting equals the current market rate. Everyone is happy.
But a year later, inflation spikes. The Federal Reserve aggressively raises rates. Now, brand new bonds being issued by Chloe's competitors are paying 7%.
Cautious Carl gets nervous and decides he wants to sell his old 5% bond to Daredevil Dave. Now, put yourself in Dave's shoes. Is Dave going to pay a full $1,000 for Carl's bond that only yields 5% when he could just log onto his brokerage account and buy a brand new bond yielding 7% for the exact same $1,000?
Of course not. Dave is reckless, but he isn't completely stupid. Dave looks at Carl and says, "Carl, your bond is inferior. The coupons are too small. I will only buy your bond if you give me a discount to make up for the missing interest."
So Carl is forced by the invisible hand of the market to drop the price of his bond to, say, $900. Now, the bond is trading at a discount. The market rate went up to 7, so the price of Carl's bond went down to 900. The seesaw moved.
Now, let's flip the scenario completely. Let's say Carl holds on to his 5% bond and a huge global recession hits. Central banks panic and cut interest rates to the bone. New bonds are only paying a miserable 3%. Now, Carl's 5% bond looks like an absolute gold mine.
Daredevil Dave comes knocking again. He says, "Carl, I want that 5% bond." Carl smiles and says, "You can't have it for $1,000. It pays way more than anything else out there. It's too valuable. If you want it, you have to pay me extra." Dave agrees to pay $1,100. The bond is now trading at a premium. Market rates went down to 3, so the price went up to $1,100.
That is the seesaw in action. Premium means you pay more than par because the coupon is better than the market. Discount means you pay less than par because the coupon is worse than the market.
But here is the most fascinating part of the life cycle of a bond. I call it pull to par, or the inevitable gravity. I have a question for you. What happens if Daredevil Dave buys that premium bond from Carl for $1,100 and he just puts it in his desk drawer and holds it all the way until maturity? Does he make $100 or lose $100?
Think about it. When the bond matures, corporate Chloe looks at the legal contract. She's only obligated to pay back the par value, which is $1,000. She does not care that Dave paid Carl $1,100 to get it. She pays $1,000.
So Dave has a built-in, guaranteed $100 loss on his principal. To account for this reality, the accounting world uses a process called amortization. Dave is slowly writing off that $100 premium over the life of the bond as a built-in loss. Why does he willingly accept this guaranteed loss? Because it perfectly offsets the great above-market 5% coupon payments he's been receiving the whole time. By the day the bond matures, his adjusted accounting basis has walked all the way downstairs from $1,100 to exactly $1,000.
And the exact opposite, called accretion, happens to discount bonds. If Dave buys a bond for $900 and holds it to maturity, Chloe still has to pay him $1,000. He has a guaranteed $100 built-in gain. His accounting basis slowly builds up or accretes from $900 toward $1,000 to replace the missing interest.
The ultimate takeaway. Every bond, no matter how wild its price swings in the secondary market, converges to par at maturity. The premium gets crushed down to par, the discount gets pulled up to par. Gravity always wins. Before we leave pricing, how do these prices actually look on a trading screen?
Corporate bonds are very straightforward. They are quoted as a percentage of par. If you see a quote of 98.5, you just move the decimal one spot to the right. That means 98.5% of $1,000, which is $985.
But treasuries are weird.
Very weird. Treasuries are a legacy system. They are quoted in 30 seconds of a point. You see a quote of 98.16, the dash is your warning sign. It does not mean $98.16. The dash 16 means 16 30 seconds. 16 over 32 is 1/2 or 0.50. So 98.16 actually means 98.50%, which again translates to $985.
Always watch out for the dash in treasury quotes. It means you have to do a fraction. Okay, we have been dancing around the concept of risk, but let's formalize them before we value these bonds. We talked deeply about interest rate risk, the risk of prices falling when rates rise, and reinvestment risk, the risk of getting stuck reinvesting cash at lower rates. I want to look at what I call the opposite twins.
They're called the opposite twins because they are perfectly inversely related. As one risk goes up, the other risk goes down. You cannot eliminate both of them at the extremes.
Exactly. Let's compare our guys again. Daredevil Dave buys a 30-year zero coupon bond. We established he has massive, terrifying interest rate risk. If overall rates go up 1%, the price of his 30-year zero craters by 30%. Boatee, he has zero reinvestment risk because he's getting no coupons to reinvest.
Right.
Now look at cautious Carl. Carl buys a 2-year bond paying a massive 10% coupon. Carl has almost zero interest rate risk. Even if rates skyrocket to 20%, his bond is maturing in 24 months anyway, so the price won't drop much because gravity is about to pull it to par. But UAT, he has massive reinvestment risk. In 2 years, he gets his whole $1,000 back, plus all those big coupons. And if rates have crashed to 1% in the meantime, he's going to be crying when he has to reinvest all that cash at terrible rates.
The exam will test this inverse relationship constantly. Short-term, high-coupon bonds have reinvestment risk. Long-term, zero-coupon bonds have interest rate risk. But what if you are a portfolio manager and you have a client who cannot afford either risk? What if you want to completely neutralize the game?
You use a strategy called duration matching, which is also known as immunization. I want to explain the why behind this because it feels like magic until you see the math.
Let's set up a scenario. You have a client who absolutely needs exactly $100,000 in exactly 5 years to pay for their child's college tuition. They cannot risk coming up short or the kid doesn't go to college. So you build a bond portfolio with a duration of exactly 5 years.
Wait, hold on. Why 5 years? How does that magically protect them from both rates going up and rates going down?
Because duration matching creates a perfect mathematical teeter-totter where the two opposing risks exactly cancel each other out over that specific time horizon. Let's say the day after you buy the portfolio, interest rates suddenly spike.
Okay, rates go up, which means the market price of your bonds immediately falls. You have an unrealized capital loss. You are losing money on paper.
True. However, because rates went up, you are now receiving your coupon payments and reinvesting them at these new, higher interest rates. You are making more interest than you originally planned. Because you matched the duration to the 5-year time horizon, the extra compounded interest you made from the higher reinvestment rates will perfectly mathematically grow over the next 5 years to exactly offset the initial drop in the bond's price.
And what if rates crash instead?
The teeter-totter tilts the other way. The price of your bonds shoots up immediately, giving you a massive capital gain on paper. But you suffer from terrible reinvestment risk, earning much less on your coupons than you planned. Over the next 5 years, the capital gain perfectly covers the shortfall in the interest you are earning. Either way, up or down, at exactly year 5, the portfolio's total value hits the target $100,000. The risks neutralize each other. That is the beauty of immunization.
That is genuinely brilliant financial engineering. Okay, let's do a speed run of the other risks you might see on the exam. Credit risk.
Also known as default risk. It is the simple risk that corporate Chloe just flat out defaults, goes bankrupt, and stops paying you.
Inflation risk.
The silent killer. It's the eater of long-term fixed rates.
Yeah.
If you're locked into a 3% bond for 30 years and the cost of groceries and housing goes up by 5% every year, your bond is technically paying you, but you are losing actual purchasing power every single day.
Liquidity risk we covered. That's the risk of being stuck with a custom marching band muni bond you can't sell. What about prepayment and extension risk?
These apply specifically to mortgage-backed securities, or MBS. They act similar to call risk. Prepayment risk is when rates drop, homeowners rush to refinance their mortgages, paying off their old loans early, and the MBS investor gets their principal back way too soon, causing reinvestment risk. Extension risk is the opposite. Rates go up, nobody refinances, everyone stays in their house, and the investor is stuck holding a low-yielding MBS for much, much longer than they originally expected.
And finally, currency and sovereign risk.
If you buy a bond from another country, say Japan, currency risk is the danger that the exchange rate between the yen and the dollar moves against you, wiping out your interest. Sovereign risk is the terrifying prospect that the foreign government itself defaults or suddenly changes their national laws to prevent you from getting your money out of the country.
Okay, take a breath. We are moving into the most mathematically intense part of the deep dive, but we are going to make it simple. We are talking about valuation and the yield ladder. How do we know what a bond is actually yielding when the market price is bouncing up and down, premiums, discounts, pull to par? How do we measure the true return?
We use different yield measurements depending on the situation and what we expect the bond to do. The two giants you need to know are yield to maturity, YTM, and yield to call, YTC.
I want to break these down thoroughly. What exactly is yield to maturity?
YTM is the granddaddy of all bond metrics. It is the total comprehensive annualized return you will get if you buy the bond today, hold it until the exact calendar day it matures, and perfectly reinvest every single coupon you receive at that exact same YTM rate. It is complex because it accounts for three things. The interest coupons you receive, PLUS, the built-in gain if you bought it at a discount, or minus the built-in loss if you bought it at a premium. It represents the true holistic measure of a bond's return over its entire life.
But what if the bond doesn't live its full life? What if Chloe kills it early?
That's where yield to call comes in. YTC assumes the exact same complex math. But instead of assuming you hold to maturity, it assumes corporate Chloe hits her remote control and calls the bond on the very first date she is legally allowed to. It calculates your return based on the call price, not the par value, and the years to the call date, not the years to maturity.
I have a direct question for the listener. I want you to synthesize what we know about Chloe's behavior. If you are holding a premium bond, meaning overall market rates have plummeted, and your bond's high coupon makes it super valuable, which yield metric matters more to you? Yield to maturity or yield to call? Take a second. Which one is actually realistic?
Think about what Chloe is incentivized to do.
The answer is yield to call. Why? Because corporate Chloe is absolutely 100% going to call that premium bond as soon as she is legally allowed to. Market rates have fallen. She wants to refinance her debt to save money. If you calculate your expected return using yield to maturity on a premium callable bond, you are lying to yourself. That bond is never going to make it to maturity. The exam will test this explicitly. For a premium callable bond, you must quote the yield to call, because it is the most realistic scenario.
Let's back up slightly and look at the simplest yield calculation you'll have to do on the exam. Current yield or CY?
Oh, this one is easy math. Current yield only cares about what the bond is paying you right now relative to what it costs right now. It completely ignores the time value of money. It ignores pull to par. It ignores what happens at maturity. The formula is annual interest in dollars divided by the current market price. Let's do an example. You have a $1,000 par bond with a 5% coupon, and the quote says it's trading at 90. Walk me through the math.
First, translate the quote. Trading at 90 means 90% of par, so the current market price is $900. Next, find the annual interest. A 5% coupon on the $1,000 par bond means it pays $50 a year. So the formula is 50 divided by 900.
And 50 divided by 900 is 5.56%. Notice something important here. The current yield of 5.56% is higher than the nominal coupon rate of 5%. Why? Because you bought the bond on sale. You are getting a full $50 a year, but you only had to invest $900 to get it. That is a better percentage return than getting $50 on a $1,000 investment.
Now we need to tie all these disparate yields together into the single most critical visual on the exam, the seesaw ladder or the yield hierarchy.
This is a critical exam concept. I don't use that term lightly. If you have scratch paper, I want you to draw this ladder the moment you sit down at the testing center. We are going to build a ladder of yields from lowest to highest.
Let's start with a discount bond. Remember, a discount bond means you bought it cheap, say for $900. As you move from left to right across the metrics, the ladder, ClimbS, it goes up.
The order is nominal yield is the lowest, then current yield is higher, then yield to maturity is higher, and yield to call is the highest. Nominal is less than CY, which is less than YTM, which is less than YTC. I want to explain the why behind this climbing ladder. Why does YTM beat current yield on a discount bond?
It's all about how much of the bond's total return each metric manages to capture. Nominal yield is blind. It just looks at the coupon printed on the paper. Current yield looks at the coupon plus the fact that you bought it cheap today. But yield to maturity looks at the coupon, PLUS, the fact that you bought it cheap, PLUS, the mathematical guarantee that the $900 bonds will accrete all the way up to $1,000 at maturity. YTM factors in that built-in $100 capital gain over time, so it results in a higher percentage number.
And yield to call is even higher because it assumes you get that same built-in $100 gain, but accelerated into a much shorter time frame when the issuer calls it early. Making $100 in 5 years is a better annual yield than making $100 in 20 years. For a discount bond, every step to the right adds more good news to the calculation.
Exactly. The discount ladder climbs. Now, visualize the exact opposite. You have a premium bond. You overpaid for it. Say you bought it for $1,100 because the coupon was so aggressively good. For a premium bond, the ladder dips. It goes down.
The order completely reverses. Nominal yield is the highest, then current yield is lower, then yield to maturity is lower, and yield to call is the absolute lowest. Nominal is greater than CY, which is greater than YTM, which is greater than YTC. And the logic is the exact inverse. Nominal is high because you have a fat coupon, but current yield drops lower because you have to divide that coupon by the huge $1,100 price you paid.
And yield to maturity is even lower because it finally forces you to factor in the built-in $100 capital loss you are guaranteed to suffer when the bond amortizes down from $1,100 to $1,000 at maturity.
And yield to call is the absolute worst of all because corporate Chloe is going to snatch the bond away from you early, forcing you to take that $100 loss prematurely, destroying your annualized return. For a premium bond, every step to the right adds more bad news.
And that reality brings us to a catch-all regulatory term, yield to worst, or YTW. Regulatory rules require brokers to quote the yield to worst to their clients before they buy a bond. It is exactly what it sounds like. It is the most conservative, lowest possible yield the investor could experience under any scenario. It is mathematically defined as the lesser of the yield to maturity, the yield to call, or any put yield. The broker has to show you the worst case scenario.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, you can answer literally any yield relationship question on the exam if you just draw that ladder on your scratch paper. Discount climbs, premium dips, par stays completely flat, meaning all the yields are equal.
Let's move to our final major area. We need to cover conversions, credit, and cash flow. These are the advanced valuation factors that push prices around based on what's happening in the equity markets and macroeconomics. Let's start with convertible bonds.
I love convertibles. They are financial hybrids. It's a bond that can morph into common stock like a transformer. Cautious Carl buys a convertible bond because it gives him the safety of a bond floor. He gets regular interest payments and priority principal protection if Chloe goes bankrupt. But it also gives him a lottery ticket. If Chloe's company invents a new technology and the stock skyrockets, his bond contract allows him to turn his debt into shares, and he can participate in the massive upside.
To evaluate a convertible, you have to know the formula for the conversion ratio. The ratio simply tells you how many shares of stock you get if you decide to transform the bond. The formula is par value divided by the conversion price.
Now, this is a massive place people lose points. What number do you always use for the numerator in that formula?
You always, always use $1,000, the par value. It absolutely does not matter if the bond is currently trading in the secondary market at $1,200 or crashing at $800. The conversion terms were locked in stone at issuance based on the standard $1,000 par value.
Let's run a scenario. Daredevil Dave holds a convertible bond. Par is $1,000. The conversion price set in the original contract is $25. What is his conversion ratio?
You take $1,000 divided by $25, which gives you 40. He has the right to trade his one bond for 40 shares of common stock.
Now, let's say the company cures a major disease and the stock price jumps to $30 a share in the open market. Dave wants to know what his bond is worth if he morphs it. What is his conversion value?
You multiply the 40 shares he's entitled to by the current market stock price of $30. 40 times 30 is $1,200. Dave's bond is now worth at least $1,200 in stock value. Boom, instant profit.
But remember, corporate Chloe, she is ruthless. She isn't just going to let Dave ride that profit to the moon forever while paying him interest on top of it. If her convertible bond also has a call feature, she will use a devious trick called forced conversion. Let's say her call price is set at $1,050, but Dave's conversion value is sitting at $1,200. Chloe issues a formal call notice. She says, Dave, I am calling your bond. I will give you $1,050 in cold, hard cash on Friday, or you have the right to convert it to stock before Friday.
Dave is practically forced at gunpoint to convert. He would be financially insane to take the $1,050 cash call when the stock he could get is worth $1,200. By issuing the call, Chloe successfully forces the debt off her balance sheet, stops paying interest, and turns Dave into an equity holder, all without having to pay him the full $1,200 out of her own pocket.
That is forced conversion. It's a brilliant corporate maneuver and a classic exam question. Moving on to bond ratings, we need to talk about the junk line.
Rating agencies like Standard & Poor's, Fitch, and Moody's exist to assess credit risk, the likelihood of default. They assign letter grades. The most important thing to know is the dividing line between investment grade and speculative, or junk. For S&P and Fitch, investment grade is BBB and above. For Moody's, is B3/3 and above. Anything below that line is considered high yield or junk.
The exam will test what happens when a bond crosses that line. Imagine a bond is rated BBB. It's investment grade. A lot of huge institutional investors, pension funds, municipal insurance companies are legally required by their share charters to only hold investment-grade bonds. Now, corporate Chloe's company has a terrible quarter. The rating agencies downgraded her bond from BBB down to BB. It crossed the junk line. This specific scenario creates what is called a fallen angel.
And what happens when a fallen angel gets downgraded? Those massive institutional investors don't just hold on and hope for the best. They can't. They are legally forced by their bylaws to dump the bond. They have to sell it immediately, regardless of price. This sudden, massive wave of forced selling causes the price of the bond to absolutely crater, and inversely, its yield skyrocket.
It's an absolute bloodbath in the market, which leads us perfectly into credit spreads. What exactly is a credit spread?
A credit spread is simply the mathematical difference in yield between a risky corporate bond and a completely safe, risk-free U.S. Treasury bond of the exact same maturity. It is the extra juice, the extra compensation that Cautious Carl demands to take on the anxiety of lending to Chloe instead of Uncle Sam. If a 10-year treasury pays 3% and Chloe's 10-year bond pays 5%, the credit spreads 2%, or what traders call 200 basis points.
I have another direct question for you listening. Think about macroeconomics and human psychology. What happens to credit spreads when the economy enters a deep, terrifying recession and everyone gets scared of bankruptcies? Do spreads narrow or do they widen? Take a second. Fear is rising.
How do investors react to fear?
Spreads widen. And this creates a fascinating, totally counterintuitive phenomenon. During a panic, investors execute a flight to quality. They blindly sell their risky corporate bonds and buy safe U.S. treasuries. Because everyone in the world is buying treasuries, treasury prices shoot up and treasury yields fall. Let's say the safe treasury yield drops from 3% to 2%. But at the exact same time, because everyone is terrified of corporate bankruptcies, they demand more extra juice to be willing to hold corporate bonds. The credit spread widens from 2% to 4%.
Let's do the math on Chloe's bond in that panic. The new base treasury rate is 2%. The new spread is 4%. 2 plus 4 means the required yield on Chloe's bond is now 6%. It went from 5% up to 6%. Because the required yield went up, the seesaw dictates that the price of her corporate bond must go down.
This means that during a recession, corporate bond prices can fall dramatically, even while treasury bond prices are rising. The widening of the credit spread completely overpowered the drop in the base interest rate. Do not assume all bonds move together.
To tie all of this valuation together, we have to end with the most fundamental concept in all of finance, discounted cash flow, or DCF. DCF is the theoretical foundation for what any asset should be worth.
It sounds incredibly complicated, but at its core, DCF is just time travel. A bond is nothing more than a legal promise of future cash payments. A $50 coupon in 6 months, another in a year, and $1,000 in 10 years. DCF asks a simple question. What is the present value of all those future cash flows if we discount them backward through time to today using our required rate of return?
We have to discount them because of the time value of money. A dollar today is worth more than a dollar 10 years from now because you can invest today's dollar and earn interest. So those future cash flows shrink as we pull them backward to the present. And the discount rate we use to shrink them is exactly what we just calculated, the risk-free rate plus the credit spread. If you run the complex DCF formula, it spits out a single precise dollar amount. Let's say it spits out $950. That is the bond's intrinsic theoretical value.
And then you take that theoretical number and you compare it to the messy real world. If the DCF formula says the bond is intrinsically worth $950, but Daredevil Dave sees it trading in the secondary market for $900, if he sees it for $900, what does he do?
If the DCF value is greater than the market price, it's cheap, BUYIT. The bond is undervalued. You are paying $900 for something mathematically proven to be worth $950.
But what if the DCF formula says it's worth $950 and it's currently trading in the market for $1,000?
If the DCF value is less than the market price, it's a ripoff. Sell. The bond is overvalued. You should never pay more than the present value of the future cash flows.
All right, take a deep breath. We have covered an absolute mountain of material, but we are going to lock it in. We're going to close this out with a rapid-fire recap. I'm going to fire quick scenarios at you, and our expert is going to give you the one-sentence exam takeaway. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Zero coupon bond taxation.
Phantom income, taxed annually as ordinary income. Always hide them in a tax-deferred account like an IRA.
Least liquid bond type on the market.
Municipal bonds. Because the market is highly fragmented with thousands of tiny local issues.
Liquidation priority in a corporate bankruptcy.
Secured, unsecured, subordinated, preferred, common. Debt always gets paid before equity.
Higher coupon means what for duration?
Higher coupon means lower duration and lower price volatility. The heavy backpack of cash grounds you.
Market interest rates go up. What happens to bond prices?
Bond prices go down. The seesaw always inverses.
Yield to worst.
It is always the absolute lowest of all possible yields calculated on the bond, usually the yield to call on a premium bond.
You crushed that. Listen, thank you so much for hanging in there with us on this deep dive. You, the listener, you have what it takes to crush the Series 65. You are putting in the work. You are doing the reps. But before we let you go, I want to hand it over to our expert for one final provocative thought. Something to chew on while you take a walk or drive home.
We spent a lot of time today talking about normal yield curves, where a longer maturity means a higher yield.
Yeah.
But I want you to ponder this. What happens to the math when the yield curve inverts and short-term two-year bonds actually start paying significantly more than long-term 30-year bonds? Historically, it's a massive recession signal. But think about our characters. How would an inverted curve completely flip cautious Carl's and Daredevil Dave's portfolios upside down? Think about how duration matching works when the whole seesaw logic of risk versus reward is temporarily completely broken by the market. It's a puzzle worth solving.
That is going to keep me up at night. Keep studying. Keep grinding. We will see you on the next deep dive.